go to the taxpayer. They do not have to go to you anymore. They're able just to say, just print up that money and away we go. And that's exactly what's going on with this business in Iraq, Afghanistan, and so forth. Used to be if they wanted to go to a war anywhere on the planet, they had to come and ask the American taxpayer. That's no longer true. There's nothing. It is the number one mechanism for growing the size, power, and scope of the federal government. Nothing, absolutely nothing out there grows government like this unlimited checking account they have with the Federal Reserve System. And the Federal Reserve System is actually kind of a hybrid. It is a private corporation, but then you have the Alan Greenspan, the head, and so forth, appointed by the president. But some people have quipped that it's actually the president appointed by the chairman. And I think the reality is something beyond it. I think both of those are both of those positions are appointed by the powers that be. People like Bill Clinton, he showed up at the Bilderberger Commission meeting before he became president. He was, no one ever heard of him. He was a big fish in a small pond down in Arkansas until he went to the Bilderbergers, gave him his spiel, and next thing you know, he's the president of the United States. So that is actually the way the power structure works in terms of choosing presidents and head of the Federal Reserve System and so forth. There's powers greater in this country than the President of the United States and the head of the Federal Reserve System. And you have to start realizing the way, in that kind of situation with the monetary system, the way that actually all works together. So there's a lot of debate by both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, about balancing the budget, and each one accusing the other of being a spendthrift and so forth and so on. But the whole thing is a sham. Anyone who really talks about balancing the budget really doesn't, is either hopelessly naive about understanding where the money comes from and what the budget really is all about, or they are hopelessly criminal. And they know where the money comes from. They know the whole thing's a con game. And either way, it doesn't bode well for the average taxpayer. One of the best books that you can get on the whole Federal Reserve System is The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. Great book. You can get it from here on Radio Liberty. And go to the website. It's a good place to find other information too, RadioLiberty.com. There's another great little pamphlet out there too, by D.V. Kidd, Why a Bankrupt America, and you can find access to that book at DEVVY.com. She's a great gal. She's spent the last several decades trying to educate as many American people as possible what's going on. One of the very most important things you can do as a citizen now is to start to understand what is going on with our monetary system. It's absolutely essential. If you really want to do something about this run-amok government, you got to understand what's fueling it, and then that is our dishonest monetary system. Just fine.
Is there any possible way that you'd be able to do that that woman that you're going to do on the 23rd rather than the 16th?
Oh, I saw her. I saw her last Saturday. So do you have someone else in mind?
Well, no. I've got my grandson's coming. And so I've got to do, he's going to be here on the 23rd, the first time he's ever been out. And so I just wonder, is there no possible way you could do her on...
Could someone do a show on the 26th?
No, I mean, maybe you've got this lady, is it, what, on the 16th? What are you doing here?
I've already done her.
Oh, you've already done her?
Yes.
What are you doing this Saturday?
I don't know I think this Saturday there's some folks in the NRA that are going to be talking about...
Okay.
Then after that, there's another NRA.
Okay.
Thank you, Carter.
Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And of course, if you'd like to give us a call, why, telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, we were to have had a guest here this evening, Steve Quayle, and we were going to be talking about biological warfare, but we don't seem to be able to reach him right at the present time. I'm going to ask our producer if he'll get our special guest on for the next hour and see if he will be willing to come on early. And if we get hold of Steve Quayle, why, we'll bring him on. Otherwise, we'll see if we can get our next guest, who is Alan Reinach, about, of course, going into the background of AB 17 and some of the legislation here in California. So we have real problems in California. As you know, we have a $38 billion deficit. Now, if you hear the Democrats talking about this, they say, look, why are you criticizing Governor Davis? Almost every state in about 48 of our states have budget deficits. They have a budget deficit, and of course the budget deficit is simply because of the turndown in the economy. It isn't fair to judge Governor Davis simply because we have a budget deficit and everybody else has a budget deficit. And, well, that really sounds very logical. There's only one problem with the argument. If you the combined budget deficits of all of the states in the United States for this year is $100 billion, and of course California has $38 billion of that $100 billion. So, and the reason that we have it is because when Governor Davis came into office, we had a budget surplus, and of course he massively increased spending about 40% in a period of 4 years, and of course he left no fund at all to take care of, you know, what would happen if the economy did turn down. And as a result, why, of course, we have a $38 billion deficit. Now, this is all massive government programs. And in fact, Arnold Schwarzenegger got an initiative for $500 million passed last time. The people of the state of California are somewhat to blame for that. I mean, they believed it when propaganda on the state proposition said, look, this is for the children. It's for the children. And it's not going to cost any money. It's not going to cost any taxes. There's not going to be any bonds issued. The money will come out of the general fund. And look what we're going to do for the children, $500 million for the children after school programs. Now, if the money isn't going to come from increasing taxes and the money isn't going to come from bonds, where's the money going to come from? It's going to come from the general fund. Where does the general fund come? It comes from you, but it's part of a $38 billion deficit. How could the people of the state of California be so stupid to vote for something like that? And how could Arnold Schwarzenegger be so stupid as to come up with an idea that there's free money and it's there for the taking and it's not going to cost anything at all? Now, I'm all in favor of children, but I think children ought to be playing basketball and baseball and all these things after school. And I don't think you need $500 million to finance that. We've got lots of facilities. We've got Little League and we've got the Pop Warner football and we've got all sorts of things that are done independent of the state. Now, if Arnold wanted to split out $500 million of his own money, I'd be all in favor of that. Or maybe even $10 million of his own money, I'd be in favor of that. But when you're going to tax every citizen for something in addition to the massive amounts, we're spending almost $9,000 on every student in the state of California now. And, of course, who can imagine if you had a class of, say, 30 students with $9,000, that's $270,000 a year. Think of the education those people would get. Think of what you could afford to pay the teachers with that amount of money. But, of course, the money doesn't go there. It goes for a massive bureaucracy. And this is the big problem that we have today, is that we have all these people have all these wonderful ideas, and, of course, they are completely without any knowledge or understanding. And, of course, all of these ideas, wouldn't it be wonderful if anybody, for instance, if your your wife, you're married, and you've got a job, but your wife is going to have a baby. It wouldn't be wonderful if you could stay home for the first 2 months and help her. And so what we'll do is we'll mandate that you get 2 months off with pay, and your employer has to put out the money. Well, we basically are in a situation where this is the law in the state of California, and and of course a lot of companies are saying, look, we can't afford a month or 2 months where we got to pay people for not working, and so a lot of more and more of our companies are leaving California. People are saying, oh, well, you know, it's really not true. Well, I don't believe that at all. You go over to Silicon Valley and it looks like a haunted area. There's just no longer the crowded parking lots over there. There's no longer the traffic over there. The Silicon Valley has collapsed. Yes, part of it has collapsed because of the dot-com collapse. But a lot of it is collapsed simply because, of course, you can't afford all of the requirements that are here. Certainly the workmen's compensation is unfriendly to business. The environmental laws are unfriendly to business. The socialist and socialist programs and this idea of paid leave is unfriendly to business. And businesses, as long as they have other places to go, are going to go there. So we've got real problems in the state of California. Now, one of the things that was brought up just today was that Arnold Schwarzenegger had voted for Prop 187. And I congratulate him for that. And Cruz Bustamante is playing the race card, trying to rally the Mexicans behind him, the Hispanics, saying, well, Arnold Schwarzenegger is against the Hispanics. Pardon me, I don't believe that's true at all. In fact, if you remember that Prop 187 won by, I think, 62 or 65%, and an awful lot of Hispanics voted for it, 187 is aimed against illegal immigrants, not against legal people who are here legally. Mexicans who've come in here, Hispanics who've come to this country legally, and I'm all in favor of them. They're hardworking people. They're good American citizens. But the people who come here illegally is an entirely different proposition. And you remember the 187 passed overwhelmingly. And then, of course, they played all sorts of games. They gave it to a Democrat judge who violated her oath of office, tied up the initiative in her courts for some years until Gray Davis got in, and then Gray Davis refused to appeal her decision, saying that this was illegal. He refused to appeal it to the Supreme Court or to a higher court. Now, basically what you've done is Gray Davis violated the law of California is Prop 187. It passed by an initiative vote. And, of course, Gray Davis violated that, and nobody had the courage during the last election to bring it up. I hope that Arnold Schwarzenegger will bring it up, and I think that certainly could win him the election, because I think that people would really rally behind him. I think that people feel, when they really understood what had happened, that the governor of the state of California, by judicial edict, first of all conspiring with the judge, and then secondly creating a commission that he picked, and that came up with a preconceived conclusion that we didn't want to appeal Prop 187. He came up with the conclusion he wanted to, and as a result, why the will of the people was thwarted. We are spending and we're wasting so much money on health care for illegal aliens, upon schooling for illegal aliens. Here in California, if you are certainly an illegal alien, you can go to our state colleges or our state universities at a special discounted price. Now, why would you do that? Well, because Governor Davis, because the liberal establishment is trying to bankrupt this state and wants to encourage people violating our laws, and people come here illegally and violate our laws and are rewarded for it. I don't blame them for coming here, but I do blame Governor Davis and the Democratic Party for supporting the lawbreakers and then for rewarding them for what they've done. Well, we got real problems in California. If you disagree, we're going to have just this first hour open, and I know many of our listeners will be up in the great state of Washington. If you agree or disagree, I would like your impression on this election that's coming up. It looks like there are going to be 160 candidates in the recall election. I think Governor Davis is going to go down. I really do. I think that we're going to have a new governor, and I'm not sure whether, who it's going to be, but I would suspect that it's going to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. There was an article in the paper this evening. It said, do you really want a governor who looks like a robot?
who acts like a robot, or an actor who's paid to look like a robot. And of course, I would rather have, in my own opinion, anybody there but Gray Davis. I just think that he is doing a terribly, terribly, terribly poor job. And if you disagree with that, if you think he's doing a great job for California, we'd love to hear from you. I think that we need to get your input. Don't just take what I say. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But certainly Governor Davis has encouraged illegal immigration. He's encouraged people to break our laws. And then, of course, he has done a terrible job with education. They've had to dumb down the tests. Of course, they have smaller class size, but class size is not the solution to education. You look over in India, they'll have 60 or 80 children in a class, and those kids are getting a wonderful education. I know when my wife went to school, there were 40 or 50 children in a class, and they got an excellent education. It's not the size of the class, it's what you're teaching the children. And if you're teaching them about death education and suicide education, if you're teaching them more about Madonna than mathematics, if children know more about Michael Jackson than they do about Andrew Jackson, if they know more about certainly about sex than they do about Shakespeare, then, of course, we're not getting a well-rounded education. And they are intentionally dumbing down our children in the classes. They have this new federal program. It's called No Child Left Behind. And, of course, they're even going to teach about the Constitution there. They're going to teach you it outmoded, that, of course, it is not applicable today. It is a living document, can be changed at any time. They'll teach you about the Bill of Rights. But, of course, they won't teach you about the important things about the Bill of Rights. They will simply teach you what they want you to know. They won't teach you about the Second Amendment. They will teach you that there's a wall of separation between church and state. And, of course, we have real, real, real problems here with the educational system, not only here in the state of California, but with the Kennedy bill that George Bush got through, which is aimed at federal control over education and using federal grants to states to change the attitudes, values, and beliefs of the children of this country, and to indoctrinate them in pagan religious beliefs. Now, of course, it said you can't teach religion. Well, they are teaching religion. They're teaching it pagan religion, the religion of the environmentalists, the religion of Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, who pushes this green foundation, the Green Cause Foundation. And the whole thrust of that is, of course, to indoctrinate children into the environment. And we're all part of the trees. We're all part of the rocks and part of the animals. We are all one with God, and in fact, we are God. That's the logical conclusion of this pantheistic philosophy, and of course, it comes right out of the pit of hell. And it is being introduced in our schools, and where is the ACLU? Where is the Americans United for Church and State when we need them? And of course, their cry is deafening in its silence. You see, the whole idea of what's happening with the wall of separation is really anti-Christian. When you understand that, that's why we're having as much trouble as we are today. And just a little off the subject, but this weekend I attended a convention, and of course one of the speakers there was the man who owns PAX Television. Now, those of you who have not seen PAX Television, let me tell you, you've pretty missed something well worthwhile. I think most of your television we would be better off without. But PAX, really, the stories there, at least those that I have watched, Doc, and there's a program on Sunday evening about a deaf FBI agent. And of course, they have Candid Camera, and they have some just wonderful, healthy programs. But a man who owns PAX mentioned that none of the major mainline television programs will have any of his key actors onto their stations. In other words, they'll have Jay Leno having all sorts of people who are crumb bums and pornographers and everything. Is his general tone is degrading to humanity and men and women, but he would never have anybody from PAX on there because, of course, what they have is wholesome. And furthermore, Gannett, the newspaper chain, had told the owner of PAX, we would never have any of your people on because, of course, they are Christian, and that means they're anti-gay, and so we don't want any bigotry on our in our newspaper. And I would just simply counter that by saying, well, then if you are pro-gay, you are obviously anti-Christian, and isn't that a bigoted position? And I really think it is, but this is really what we're up against. Let me suggest that, although I don't recommend you spend a lot of time watching television, PAX television, which you can get off your cable, which you can get off your satellite, is well worthwhile watching. And once you get started watching at least Doc and this program about the deaf FBI agent, you'll get as hooked as I know our family has. And these are programs that have a wonderful spiritual uplifting message. And when you get through watching them, why, you feel good about yourself and good about America and good about Christianity. Because even though they're not entirely about Christianity, there's always a Christian message woven in there. And you remember Touched by an Angel, what we had. Never once did they mention Jesus Christ on that. But, of course, this one does mention Jesus Christ. And even quotes from the scriptures there, of course, giving the Christian message very, very strongly. And what we're really up against is anti-Christian bigotry that controls the media today, which is why, they embrace the homosexual lifestyle. And if you really cared about homosexuals, you'd tell them what you're going to do is going to kill you. Don't you know that? I mean, the average homosexual lives to about 41 years of age. Why? Because of all the diseases he gets, not because of the incidence of suicide is so high. We've already lost over a quarter of a million homosexuals who've died of AIDS in America today. And we just never talk about that. And, of course, the incidence of AIDS is rising within the homosexual population because it's being encouraged so much and because they've been lied to and told, oh, they're wonderful treatments for the disease. And if you really wanted to kill off the homosexuals, you couldn't do a better job. And let me tell you something that I learned, although I have never talked about this, but back in about 1988 when I was in the middle of the AIDS fight trying to do something to begin to introduce the use of standard public health techniques and to save the lives of people, homosexuals, heterosexuals, black, white, anybody, because, of course, the purpose of medicine is to prevent people from getting diseases that are going to kill them. And that's, of course, the purpose with every disease but AIDS. And, of course, I had a friend of mine, a doctor in this community, had gone back to Washington, D.C. to testify before a congressional committee on the AIDS epidemic and the fact that we weren't really trying to use the effective public health techniques that could have been used at that time to stop the spread of the disease. And Congressman Dannemeyer had invited us back. And, of course, my friend had gone to Congressman Dannemeyer and said, hey, how about getting me an appointment at the White House? So Congressman Dannemeyer got to him an appointment with one of Gary Bauer's assistants. And Gary Bauer at that time was in charge of public policy and affairs. And so at that time, my friend went to the White House. And then after he got back, he told me what had happened. And what he had been told by the president's advisor was that during the early part of the AIDS epidemic, they had decided at the White House, these are the men who advised the president, who really ran him. He didn't make these decisions. They were made by his advisors. And they decided to actually not to intervene, to let the epidemic run, because it was primarily a disease of homosexuals and IV drug users. And it really wasn't until 1997, by 1987, that the policy changed. But they were quite willing to let the homosexuals die. And it's very, very hard, I think, for the average individual to believe that that would be the attitude. And that's exactly what the homosexuals were saying at the time. And I sort of rejected that. I didn't want to believe it. Unfortunately, it was really true. And, of course, it wasn't until 1987 when Ronald Reagan came out and gave a speech saying we ought to try to address the epidemic and stop its spread because it is getting into the heterosexual population. And, of course, at that time, nothing was really done to stop it. The great, great tragedy is an awful lot of homosexuals died, and they died unnecessarily because of that. Well, we're going to, of course, have to take a break here, let our listeners up in the Great Northwest listen to some of our promotionals, and then we'll be back with them. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I think we have Mary on the line. Hi, Mary. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Well, tell us what you think about the gubernatorial race.
Well, I agree with you. I want to see Davis out, but I don't think, I'm sorry that I heard that ISA dropped out.
Yes, Daryl Issa did, and I certainly give him a lot of courage, a lot of credit for having the courage and the desire to put up his own money to get the recall election to become a reality. Unfortunately, he realized there was just no way he could compete with Bush Schwarzenegger and, you know, and then compete with McClintock as well, because those are the only two candidates that I can see that really could make a difference. And I think that even Tom McClintock is, with the full support of the Republican Party, and because I can't tell you who I'm going to vote for, but you may be able to guess, having heard McClintock, I will tell you he's one of the most dynamic people, and you'll be hearing him on our various programs. But the reality is that people are going to vote, the average individual is going to vote, not with thinking what the issues are, they're going to vote for the ideal, what they've seen on the television screen. I think they're going to vote for Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I think that he's going to win, you know, hands down, unless, of course, they can come up with a lot of dirt in the next 2 months to discredit him. But what are your thoughts on that? Tell me.
Well, I would have voted for Isaac because he did put up his own money, and I think he probably has a good chance because it's the person with the money, the one who can do the advertising. And even though McClintock is a good person, because I heard his interview too, I don't think he probably has the money that a Schwarzenegger has, but I won't vote for Schwarzenegger. I don't think he would be any good.
All right, fine. Why now? Give me the reasons why you don't think he'd be good. And I'm not disagreeing or with you at all. I just want to know why. Of course, what's the basis you're feeling?
Well, I mean, what are his qualifications? Because he married somebody in the Kennedy family? and just that, to me, like there was a mark against him. So.
All right, fine.
But I'm real disappointed. I was so shocked to hear that a person would put up that much money and then back out.
Well, I think that he's realistic, and I saw the tearful concession speech, and he was actually crying when he said, you know, I almost had difficulty saying, I've got a lot of work to do in Congress, and I'm not going to run. He was really hurt by this. You know, I like Daryl Issa myself, and I really like to get him on, and maybe we get him on some evening and just talk to him about, you know, how he feels about the world. And I think I've talked to him in the past, and my impression was he's a good conservative. Maybe not quite as good as Tom McClintock is, but of course I think he's a good conservative.
Well, it's like I said, though, it's the person with the money. And the thing is, I wonder if he could be encouraged if he found out that people, you know, we're not all that dumb, you know, that we're going to go with who they put up in front of us, like, oh, you'll vote for him. I usually go the opposite way myself, but I don't know. I'm just thinking, what about even writing his name in? Because if it's a foregone conclusion that Schwarzenegger's going to get in, why vote for him? Just let those people put him in and do something better with your vote.
All right, fine, Mary. I certainly respect you for what you're saying. And you're saying make a principal vote rather than, of course, vote for the person you think is going to win.
Right.
Do something that you think is right. And maybe if enough people stood for what was right, we wouldn't be in the mess we are today.
Could I ask you something about Issa? Didn't he get involved in the election before? I think it was when Huffington was running?
No. Basically, we'll be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
And we'll talk. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and now welcome our guest back from the Great Northwest. And, of course, the question has been raised, of course, was Daryl Issa involved? He's actually, as I recall, been involved in a couple of other issues. He was involved in the Spanish-only, and somebody out there, they want to correct me, they can, but pardon me, the English-only education, and he was really pushing that very, very heavily, and he got that initiative through. He's got a couple of initiatives, as I recall, through, and then, of course, he used that as a platform to run for Congress, which he did, and he now is, of course, a congressman from Southern California. But as I remember, he was not running with, certainly I don't think he would have supported Huffington. I certainly hope not.
Well, I guess that was it. I just knew I'd seen his name before and thought maybe that was it.
No, you know, he's certainly a very colorful individual. He's a very articulate gentleman, and I think my impression is on most issues we would tend to agree with him on. My understanding is pro-gun and he's a pro-life, and those are two important issues. You know, really, he really understands about globalization, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Brotherhood of Darkness. I don't know. Maybe we ought to get him on the line and talk to him sometime.
You know what really makes me mad about liberals and people who are ruining this country? They don't use their own money. And I really respect a person who will use their own money. To me, that says they really stand for something.
Well, I certainly would tend to agree with you on that.
Well, thanks, Dr. Stan.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And that was Mary from Covina. And if you're out there, thank you so much, Mary. And if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, we were to have had Steve Quayle on tonight talking about the danger of biological warfare and for one reason or another why we don't have him with us. So we'll try to get him on at a later time. But if you have any question at all, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And certainly I have a caller who's called in and said, what about Bill Simon? Isn't he a conservative? Well, I've met Bill Simon on a number of occasions and talked to him. And I think that, of course, he knows what conservatives want to hear. But his father, of course, came from the Council on Foreign Relations. He, of course, was the establishment's candidate. He was run, I believe, 2 years ago, he and Reardon, to block the real conservative running for governors, and that was Bill Jones. And, of course, Simon is perhaps more articulate than Bill Jones, but Bill Jones is as solid as he can be, and he would have made a wonderful governor. But with Reardon and of course, Simon splitting the vote, and, of course, then Simon getting the Republican nod, they defeated the conservative. And really, you know, Bill Simon is nowhere near as conservative as he pretends to be now. He'll say what we want to hear. But, of course, I don't believe he really means an awful lot of what he says. And when we saw him coming out and courting the homosexual vote and perhaps waffling on his pro-life stand, you know, when he was running for governor, trying to be more moderate, why I was not really a very enthusiastic supporter during the last election. So I hope that will answer the question. I think Tom McClintock is a real arts conservative, if you want to call it arts. I believe he believes in conservative principles. I believe he believes in cutting spending. But more than that, I believe he believes in the other issues of individual freedom under God and our Constitution. That's my impression, having heard him speak and talked to him personally many times off the air. So, but there'll be people out there who disagree with me, and that's what makes Talks Radio interesting. So if you disagree, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. I'm going to ask my producer to bring a little water in here for me because it looks like it's going to be a long evening until we, of course, get our guest during the next hour. So that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, I think there are a lot of people out there who really are very, very concerned about what's happening to our country. I believe that, of course, this election really is going to have a profound impact not only on our state, but I think on the entire nation. And, you know, basically when Schwarzenegger announced he was going to run, why, of course, everything changed. And suddenly Bustamante came in the race, Daryl Issa dropped out, because you can't really fight the Hollywood image. I know over this weekend I had the opportunity of watching television. I usually don't bother to, but here I had an opportunity to watch it. It was amazing how many of the articles, how many of the programs were dealing with Schwarzenegger and showing his own movies, talking about him. They hardly mentioned Tom McClintock or Bill Simon or any of the other major runners-up. It was Schwarzenegger, Schwarzenegger, Schwarzenegger. And you have to understand that they control our reality. They control what the American people think. And with the media, or many of them solidly behind him, why, of course, I think it's a foregone conclusion who our next governor here in the state of California may very well be. It's going to be interesting to see. If we're right, we'll be right back here. Dr. Standback here, and of course, our regular scheduled guest this evening, Steve Quayle, didn't show up. So it's just going to be you and me for this next half hour. And if there's anything you would like to talk about, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And we don't have to talk about the California election. We can talk about whatever you're concerned about. Or perhaps we can talk about really what is happening to the economy of our nation, to the economy of our state. Because, of course, what most people do not understand, they know, of course, we've been into a recession. We certainly saw the bottom drop out of the stock market, and now we see the stock market coming back again. And everybody, of course, is being told, oh, we're coming out of the recession. All the experts say we're coming out of the recession. Those are the same experts we're talking about, the stock market going, to 20 or 30 or 40,000. Those are the same experts that told us we were in the new economy. And, of course, the NASDAQ would, go to a 20 or 30,000. And they were lying to us then, and they're lying to us now. And maybe they don't know, or maybe they are simply extensions of this establishment, this brotherhood of darkness we talk about. But under any circumstances, we are in a whole new world. And this new world is brought about by the fact that, of course, the leaders of both political parties are dedicated to globalization. Now, what is globalization? Globalization is the process of bringing about a one-world government. And, of course, from taking from those who have so much to give to those who have so little. Or as Karl Marx had said so well, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And this whole idea, of course, of free trade, which we hear so much about, was something that Karl Marx strongly advocated. And basically he said this. He said, when you have this free trade situation, why, of course, you're going to have a lot of people losing their jobs. You're going to create social unrest, and that then will facilitate the revolution. And what most people do not understand is some of the wealthiest people in America are totally dedicated to Marx's concepts, because Karl Marx didn't really advocate redistributing the wealth of the wealthy. He wanted to redistribute the wealth of the middle class. Karl Marx, of course, said one thing, but he really believed in rule by an elite. This is what Marxism is really all about. Karl Marx was financed by a secret society known as the Society of the Just. Now, you're not going to read about this. You need to go back to the British Encyclopedia Britannica. We have a 1913 edition, and it talks about the Society of the Just, which was, of course, one of the myriad of secret societies that existed during the 19th century. In fact, everything that happened during the 19th century was bound up in secret societies. And if you think that sounds like an absurd statement, you really need to get one of the most important books that we carry. It's called Fire in the Minds of Men. And it was written by James H. Billington, who was certainly not a right-wing fanatic, a conservative, black helicopter-believing fanatic. James H. Billington is the Librarian of Congress, a historian of great renown, a member of the editorial staff of the Council on Foreign Relations, and longtime a member of the CFR, the elite group that controls our society. And of course, he talks about in his book Fire in the Minds of Men how the major force in the world today and behind this whole world revolutionary movement are secret societies, not only secret societies, but occult secret societies, and as he brings out so well. Of course, this whole movement towards the world revolution was brought about when, of course, men began to remove their lighted candles from the Christian altars and place them onto Masonic altars, and, of course, transferring their allegiance from the God of the Bible, of course, to the occult. And that's really about, this is really all about. This whole idea of bringing about a world government is all about really bringing about the Antichrist into power. And, of course, they understand this. They are working towards a ruling elite under their control. But, of course, there will be a new world leader. Now, I'm not saying they all understand that they're working for the Antichrist, but some of them do. Some of them have simply given themselves over to the dark side in return for tremendous material prosperity and wealth and power and sex and unlimited and unbridled licensedness, which is what this is really, really, really all about. So, of course, these people then work through these various covert and secret organizations. And, of course, their goal has always been a one-world government, a new world order. And those of you who have read my book, of course, The Brotherhood of Darkness, we simply quote in that book from the writings of Manly P. Hall. And, of course, you really need to read Hall to understand so much of what's going on in the world today. But he will, of course, come right out and tell you how this all really fits together. And, of course, he will tell you that there have been, since the beginning of time, these people who have been working within secret societies, within the democracies, to bring about this idea of world government. And he talks about the people who came here with secret societies during the period of the 1640s. And, of course, it was out of those secret societies that came this one world order that, of course, we see being enacted today. And let's see if I can find the exact quotation. And the one advantage to my book is the fact it's beautifully indexed. And I just looked up the world democracy. And so here's the quotation from Manly P. Hall. For more than 3,000 years, secret societies have labored to create the background of knowledge necessary to the establishment of an enlightened democracy among the nations of the world. Men bound by a secret oath to labor in the cause of world democracy decided that in the American colonies they would plant the roots of a new way of life. Brotherhoods were established to meet secretly, and they quietly and industriously conditioned America to its destiny for the leadership of a free world. Now, you have to understand that he goes on to say, on the reverse of our nation's great seal is an unfinished pyramid to represent human society itself, imperfect and incomplete. Above floats the symbol of the esoteric orders, the radiant triangle with its all-seeing eye. There is only one possible origin for these symbols, and that is the secret societies which came to this country 150 years before the Revolutionary War. Well, the Revolutionary War was in the mid 1775. 150 years before that would have been, of course, during the early years of the formation of the United States in the 1630s. And my understanding is that the secret societies came here about 1640 to bring about this one world government that these people espoused. And the fact that most people don't understand that. Now, the quotation I just gave you comes from a book written by Manly P. Hall called The Secret Destiny of America. Manly P. Hall was a Satanist. He was a member of the upper echelons of Masonry. In fact, when he died, the Masonic Order referred to him in the Scottish Rite magazine as the greatest Masonic philosopher of all time. The Scottish Rite magazine said that Manly P. Hall was the greatest Masonic philosopher of all time. He was a Satanist. And if you read his books, and of course he wrote 40 or 50 of them, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, or The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, or Lectures on Ancient Philosophy, or The Secret Destiny of America, I just quoted from, you begin to understand that this man, of course, was one of the leaders. And he talked about this whole idea of democracy, this new world order, this democratic one world system. Well, when he refers to democracy, you must understand he's talking about rule by an elite. Because, of course, he understood what Plato had written, because Plato was part of the mystery religions as well, as was Aristotle, as was Alexander the Great, as was, of course, Socrates, and as was Pythagoras before them. All of those people of ancient Greece were tied into the ancient mystery religions, and, of course, that's, of course, why their writings have been promoted down through the centuries and as the great philosophers, because there was always a hidden force behind them. And when you see somebody today who's, there's always somebody promoting them and saying how smart they are, you know very well that they're being promoted by the people working behind the scenes. Well, anyway, of course, the whole idea of this globalization is, of course, to create a one-world order and a one-world religion. And going along with that, of course, it means the transfer of America's industrial capacity and industrial jobs to other countries. To each according to his ability, to each according to their need. That's what it's all about. And so, since George Bush came into office, we have lost 2.5 4 million jobs. Now, those are not just companies closing down because they can't produce. Those are jobs that have gone offshore that will never come back again. Now, these are industrial jobs. There have been another half a million. I think the overall figure is 3,150,000 jobs in total that have left America. Bank of America is transferring its loan division to India. Many of our computer firms have their support in Bangladesh or in Pakistan. And, of course, what we're seeing is the redistribution of America's wealth throughout the world. That is your future and your children's future. And, of course, the plan is to certainly impoverish gradually the American people. But, of course, we don't want the American people to understand that. And, of course, the Democrats will blame the Republicans. The Republicans will blame the Democrats. But really, the leaders of both political parties, this is their hidden agenda because, you know, these men are simply figureheads. Remember Bill Clinton? Remember Bill Clinton? When he got out of office, the first thing, he got a $10 million contract to write a book he hasn't written yet. And then he made $10 million in the speaker's fee for the first year he was out of office. Now, do you honestly believe that Bill Clinton is worth $10 million to hear him speak? Of course not. You know, he was getting $100,000, $200,000 a smack for his talks. And this is simply how you bribe the people, how you reward them for services rendered. And, of course, Bill Clinton, as with, of course, all of our presidents, have been pushing this idea of the one world order, the coming world government. And have to understand that the purpose is to impoverish the American people. And so they, of course, destroyed the value of 30% of the value of your holdings over this past, over this past 2 years. The dollar has lost 30% of its purchasing power in comparison with the euro. And, of course, I believe that the euro eventually will become the predominant currency in the world. They're doing everything in Europe now to get their economy in order. We're not doing anything here to get our economy in order. We're just spending and spending as if, of course, there is no tomorrow. The national debt for this year was acknowledged to be $645 billion. That's billion dollars. Pardon me, that's $465 billion. $465 billion. That's almost $500 billion, but they don't tell you about the money they're going to steal from Social Security and Medicare, which will bring the figure up almost to $750 billion. That's almost $750 billion in one single year. Now, how could you do that? How could you spend that much money? Our deficit with foreign deficit, now that's different than the federal deficit. Our foreign deficit, in other words, the amount of money we spend in other countries in comparison with what we import from other countries, the differential between what we export and what we import will be $500 billion, which of course gives these other countries the ability to come in here and buy our bonds and buy our property and buy whatever they want to. They believe in buying America. And we're transferring the wealth of this country to other countries. And many of these foreign countries are coming in. They're simply buying up our factories, lock, stock, and barrel, and moving them offshore. These things are happening in America today. And where is the outcry? Well, because they control the media. You're not hearing these things talked about. Everybody says, oh, well, you know, we go into a recession and the economy comes back. No, ladies and gentlemen, the economy doesn't come back because the jobs aren't coming back. We are actively encouraging and financing the companies to move offshore. I did a program earlier today with John Nash, who worked for Roger Milliken, who has a group trying to let the American people know what's going on. We've given the Chinese communists hundreds of millions of dollars to develop their ports so they can more readily send their products over to the United States. People who are companies moving overseas are giving financial incentives. They're giving cash incentives. They are giving tax breaks to move their plants overseas. And in fact, they are punished if they bring the profits back to the United States, because the whole thrust of our government is to get our industries to move offshore and to build up the economies of third world nations. After all, those people have so little. And wouldn't it be wonderful, of course, we transferred the wealth of America from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And, of course, what they really want is to impoverish the American people, because when the American people are impoverished, they'll be just scrambling to survive. The elderly, of course, will be certainly put into a terrible situation because as the value of their fixed assets is destroyed, the value of their bonds and of their annuities and their pension funds. Oh, you may very well, of course, get, you know, $1,000 a month, but $1,000 a month may buy, you know, half a dozen loaves of bread. You say that could never happen in America. And I would simply ask, why couldn't it happen in America? Not only because we have wicked people in positions of power in both political parties, but also, of course, because America has turned against God. And what everybody, of course, misses is that there's a spiritual component to everything that's going on. And do you really believe that God is going to continue to bless a country that's turned against him, that embraces, gay marriages, where the Episcopalian Church is bringing in a bishop who left his wife and children for another man? And, of course, where is the outcry from the Christian churches of America today? Oh, we don't want to be critical after all. God's behind all of these things. He must be behind it because that's what we've been told. I mean, after all, wasn't that what Paul said to the Romans in Romans 13? God's behind everything. And well, if God's behind everything and the wars and the abortion, the partial birth abortion and the mass murder and genocide and diseases that are being created, that's not the sort of God that I worship. He may allow these things to happen because he gives us the opportunity to intervene. And I believe the Christian church has been tried and found wanting. And I believe we're going to see terrible times here in America simply because the church has abandoned the traditional teachings and, of course, has abandoned America. We've got Bill calling from Florida. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I wanted to add there to your comments about gay marriage and, and all that stuff being, sanctioned now by the courts and everything. If you remember in
the big sanction by the church. Don't forget the church is going
the church
along
is too, and they're going contrary to the Bible because the Old and New Testament doesn't say homosexuality per se, but man sleeping with man, woman with woman, that type of thing, or man with beast is an abomination in the sight of God, and in the Old Testament, the books of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, the Israelites would take someone caught in an act like that, or even fornication or adultery, take them outside the camp and stone them to death, And what bothers me is these treaties that we keep signing that we can go bring somebody back from a foreign country and try them here without extraditing them, which in turn allows those countries to come and if somebody speaks out against abortion, or not so much abortion, but against homosexuality, they can come into this country now, from what I've heard, and take those people back to that foreign country and try them there under their laws, because a lot of European countries have laws on the books that, you can't say anything bad about homosexuality.
Well, they can't yet, but I think that day is going to come, and it's going to come because the good people aren't doing anything, and we need to get those people of Florida to listen to our programs and understand that, of course, we can talk about this thing from a historical point of view, we can talk about it from a political point of view, but if we don't address it from a spiritual point of view, we're missing what it's all about.
Right. One other thing I wanted to ask, if maybe you or any of the listeners out there, I'd heard on the radio program the other day about Bush has said he would sign the reenactment of the assault weapons ban when it comes due before, I guess a year from September, at sunsets. And I heard someone mention that they had introduced new legislation called the Victory Act, and I looked on Thomas.gov and I couldn't find it. And the program I was listening to didn't give any Senator House bill number, but it's supposed to be very draconian as far as banning assault rifles, which are basically look-alike military rifles, semi-automatic shotguns, and the guy even went on to say pump shotguns and even double-barrel shotguns because they can be can be considered assault weapons. But
well, they're not assault weapons, and they know it not.
Yeah.
And you can call, you know, you can call a pig a chicken, but it still is a pig.
Right.
And of course, the fact that George Bush would go along with this, I think, tells you a lot about George Bush and what his real agenda is.
Yeah,
he says one thing and then he does another, and no Christian who really loved the Lord and feared God would simply lie to the people. I don't care what. He would stand for what he believes. What we need are men in positions of power who fear God. We're going to have Larry Pratt on, and of course he is, of course, doing everything he can to bring pressure to bear on Governor Bush, President Bush, to let him know that if he, of course, does what he's threatening to do, he will lose the support of his constituents. He thinks he can take the Christians and the conservatives for granted, and I think we better let him know that he can't. And even if he has $100 million in his kitty to get reelected, I think there might even be some people that vote for Hillary Clinton. At least we'd know who the enemy really is.
Yeah, that's true. And I think too, with President Bush, you know, claiming to be a born again Christian, if he really was, the Holy Spirit would convict him of being in the Skull and Bones and the Masonic Order. I seen on one of David Wegener's tapes, it shows a picture of just before he was elected or sworn in, you know, in that time period. They were sitting in church, and he was sitting to the right of his father and reached over to shake hands and did the Masonic, you know, the secret Masonic handshake.
No, I can't comment on that. I really don't know about it.
But if he was truly a Christian, you know, he would denounce the Skull and Bones, and he would denounce the Masonic Order, and
well,
he is
I'm not sure that he is a Mason. He may be. I've never really been able to verify that.
When I seen the handshake, having been a former Mason myself, they zoomed in on it with the camera, whoever was taking the pictures that David got them from. They zoomed in on it, and it was definitely a Masonic handshake.
Well, that's very
unless the Bonesmen have the same handshake, which is possible.
Well, of course, we know, for instance, that the Mormonism is an offshoot of Masonry. Perhaps Skull and Bones is too. I don't know. Hey, we got to go. Anything else you want to say? We got something else going.
Good luck and keep you know, hope you keep your health and everything goes good with your shoulder.
God bless. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you. I'll be praying for you.
Okay. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. We've got Mike coming on. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. Regarding Bush and Masonry, you know, he, for his inaugural, for his oath of office, he used the Masonic Bible.
Okay. Well, I had heard that. And
I'm trying to pull up some details right now.
All right, fine. Well, if you come up with anything, let us know.
No, I'm just trying to find my file on it, but anybody can find it on the net if they've put in keywords, Bush inaugural Masonic Bible.
All right, fine.
There's dozens of articles about it.
All right, fine. We know that he's definitely in Skull and Bones. He has, of course, poo-pooed the idea there's anything secret about it. He will not come out and condemn this, but this is a pagan organization, and anybody who has not got our 4-tape set on Skull and Bones, where we actually interview Alexandra Robbins, who describes one of the pagan ceremonies that was seen by an outsider, or they're there with their black hoods and their candles and these pagan chants, and this is a Skull and Bones wedding. It's pretty scary to think that our president would be involved in something like that. And now that he's a Christian, he would not denounce it.
Yeah, no, they dragged in a special Bible from New York City, a very, very old copy that apparently George Washington used for his inaugural.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, fine. Well, thanks so much, Mike. Anything else you'd like to say?
That's it. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Bye-bye. Okay, well, we're talking really about globalization, about the transfer of America's wealth to other countries. And really, we are sending our wealth to other countries. We're sending it to communist China. Our deficit with communist China was $106 billion last year. How much it'll be this year, I don't know. But you have to understand that, of course, we are subsidizing communist China. We're giving them, just gave them the money to develop their plants. We're lending them money there, to build this massive new dam, this biggest dam in the world, to dam up the Yangtze River. And, of course, this is going to then to produce electricity for their industrialization. We have today 14 million industrial jobs in the United States, 14 million manufacturing jobs. The Chinese communists have to create between 10 and 15 million new jobs every year, of course, just to keep their people busy. They are developing a tremendous industrial capacity, and we are transferring our jobs to communist China, not by accident, but by intent, because there is an agenda. And, of course, until people understand the move towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, they can't understand anything going on today. None of this makes sense. I mean, why would we tell the American people, oh, we've got to have a NAFTA because, of course, we have to have, all these things we're going to be able to sell to all those Mexican peasants down there. Look at all the new jobs we're going to create for America. America's going to boom with open free trade. They knew it was a lie, but of course they were able to convince the American people. They were able to twist the arms of the finest politicians money could buy in Congress, and of course to get NAFTA and the World Trade Organization through it. Oh, the World Trade Organization, look at all those Chinese communists. They're going to buy all of our things that we make, you know, the televisions we make and the computers we make, and we don't make any of those things. They're all made in, well, now they're made in China, but, you know, before they were made in South Korea, and they were being, even Japan is sending so many of their things into China to be made today. But, of course, you know, when wealth comes from the ability to produce or the ability to farm or the ability to grow, and, of course, the jobs are centered around manufacturing, around farming, around fishing, certainly around mining, and this is the source of wealth, and we're transferring it all out of this country. And of course, even our mines, we're not allowed to put in new mines because, of course, the environmentalists won't let us. Who's behind the environmentalists? Why, the great industrialists? Who do you think put us the money for the environmental movement? The great tax-exempt foundations, the great corporations, and of course, our own government is financing these people who are restricting the development of mines and, of course, drilling for oil up in Alaska, so we'll be dependent upon other countries. This is all part of a gigantic scam. And until people understand that, they can't understand what's going on today. Well, we do hope that many of you out there will, of course, want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Our newsletter this month is really one of the most interesting I've ever made. It's a two-month letter. It's for the month of July and August. It's, what's 16 or 12 pages long. It's a very, very long letter, much longer than ordinary. And, of course, we are not going to send free copies of that out. You're either going to have to get it off the Internet, or you're going to have to either subscribe to the newsletter or join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. But we hope that many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family. And if you're interested, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we're dependent upon you for what we do, for being on this station, for being on stations 5 hours a day, and then our weekend program that's heard at 35 different stations across America. And we're getting people to hear what they will never hear elsewhere, a true understanding from a historical and political aspect of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged, that battle that will determine what sort of a world our children and our grandchildren will live in. Or if, of course, the dream that was America will soon become a nightmare. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, do you honestly believe that God is going to allow us to have the same luxury and prosperity we've had in the past? We ask you to pray for our ministers, because they should be leading this this truly spiritual battle, and so few of them are. If you've got a good minister, back him in every way that you can. We just need more like him. Set up an Institute of the Constitution in your area. If you need more information on that, you can always call us, and we'll tell you how to set up an Institute of the Constitution, and then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be back with you again, and hopefully we'll have a guest, Dr. Stan, goodbye. May the Lord be with you.
peace of God forever with the grace.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Alan Reinach, and we're going to be talking about AB 17 and the gay marriage initiative that is here in California. Alan, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Stan.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I head up the public affairs and religious liberty work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church in a 5-state western region. We deal with a lot of legislative issues. Our main concern is protecting the rights of conscience for people of all faiths, Christian or otherwise. Doesn't matter. God, the way God made us, He gave us freedom. And we have the freedom to worship God or to believe what we're going to believe. And, of course, with that freedom, we're also going to be accountable for both our actions and our beliefs. So that's, I guess, the core principle of our ministry. I'm also a minister as well as an attorney. And increasingly, we're dealing with legislation here in California that is aimed at restricting the religious freedom of religious institutions.
All right, and of course, we see this at every turn, and I think that one of the best examples of that was the transvestite bill, of course, which has something like a $150,000 fine for the Boy Scouts or even a Christian bookstore that won't hire a transvestite. And, of course, you have to prove that you weren't guilty or, of course, you'll be subject to these draconian punishments. It's not they have to prove you guilty. No, you are guilty until proven innocent.
You know, I have not honestly taken a close look at the impact of that particular bill. So I can't comment on just how it will work in operation. We have been focused very clearly on AB 17, which is really an attempt to put religious institutions out of business.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us what is AB 17?
Sure. AB 17 is a simple requirement that everybody that has a contract with the state would have to provide the same benefits to domestic partners that they provide already to spouses of their employees. And, you know, on its face, it appears to apply to everybody. The problem, of course, is that federal law preempts state regulation of employee benefits. They're regulated by federal law. And the only significant part of the workforce that is exempt from the federal law are religious organizations. So in effect, this AB 17 really targets religious institutions to violate their faith and to provide benefits to gay couples.
All right, and of course, this is simply another ruse to a little bit by little bit, taking a little here, there, a little elsewhere. You know, and each time it doesn't seem like that's much, but eventually, of course, all religious freedom is gone. And to say that we have to recognize homosexual relationships or marriages, or call them what you will, when we feel that they're wrong, certainly flies in the face of what about our rights as individuals? What about our rights as employers?
Well, you know, you mentioned the issue of marriage, and it strikes me that marriage historically is a religious institution. Certainly as Christians, marriage is one of the founding institutions of the Bible. It goes back to Genesis, to the first chapters of Genesis, and the state is really a Johnny-come-lately in exercising any jurisdiction over marriage. For the state to now contemplate redefining the meaning of marriage is really for the state to intrude upon what is primarily and at its heart a religious institution. And the state has no right to define a religious institution.
Well, whether it has a right or not, I mean, the state takes unto itself all sorts of powers that were never intended by the people, of course, who, agreed to this whole idea of government. In fact, we're told in the Declaration of Independence that we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that governments are instituted among men to protect these rights, to guarantee those rights. The purpose of government is to guarantee our right to life, liberty, and, of course, the pursuit of happiness, not our right to do whatever the state wants us to do.
Well, you know, Stan, and I don't know if you remember, it's been a while since I've been on your show, but your commitment to liberty, and I appreciate your reminding the listeners about the origins of our rights, really that is the Republican, not as in Republican Party, but the Republican principle upon which this nation was founded, that it is government of, by, and for, not the state, but the people. And really, the history, particularly in the last half of, well, ever since the New Deal, I think, has been to turn American principles of Republican government upside down, and we are now really government of, by, and for the state, not for the people.
I think you're absolutely right, and of course the thing is that the whole idea of the republic and form of government, both the federal and the state level, is that what the government would do is to be limited by the powers of law, and every state has to be a republic. And the republic is a system not of democracy where the elected representatives can do whatever they want to, but where they can do what they can according to the restrictions placed on them. What we've done is substitute this idea that whatever the elected people want to do, our elected representatives want to do, they can do, and they will do. And that is not what it should be at all. In fact, if you look at the Constitution of the State of California, in the first paragraph, it talks about our duty to God. Do these legislators even read the Constitution? Because, of course, what they're advocating is a violation of God's law.
Well, you know, my mind is racing as I'm listening to you, and I think about the Texas sodomy case, because this presents a very interesting problem in what are the limitations on government and what are the legitimate powers or constitutional rights of the people. I don't think that the Founding Fathers believed that they had completely delineated all the rights of the people. And personally, I don't have a problem with a court saying government should stay out of people's bedrooms, that people have a basic right to privacy. But I do have a problem when the court says that the majority cannot criminalize certain kinds of immoral conduct. And so maybe I'm splitting the baby, so to speak, but I think that government, that the majority does have the right to criminalize immoral sodomy type of conduct, and that it may be that in doing so you should not intrude upon the bedroom, but that doesn't mean that the conduct itself can't be made illegal.
Well, I think, of course, the trouble with the Texas sodomy law, I think Anthony Scalia put it very forcefully. First of all, it was not something that the federal government should have been involved in at all. Matters dealing with life, liberty, property, and morality were always to be taken care of at the state and the local level. And, of course, the whole idea of the federal system was that you would have a federal government that was to have to do with matters between countries, that would have to do with matters within states, and the only function of the federal government, coin and mint money and handle piracy and have an army and defend America. But of course, the restrictions on what the government could do were pretty well laid out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Only those things that are listed there, and about 17 of them, that was all the federal government was to do. Matters dealing with life, liberty, and morality, and property were all to be handled at the state and the local level, and that's very specifically spelled out in the 45th of the Federalist Papers, which everybody understood at the time our Constitution was ratified was what the Founding Fathers anticipated. Now, what
there's no question, let me jump in here, because there's no question that James Madison lost the battle in the drafting of the Constitution. He wanted the First Amendment in particular, but I think in a general sense wanted the Bill of Rights to apply to the states, and he lost that battle against the Anti-Federalists. But the same battle was fought less than 100 years later after the Civil War, and at that point the Federalists won because of the shocking, because of the slavery issue and the deprivation of the human rights of the slaves. The Federalists won the right to apply the basic protections of the Bill of Rights to as a restriction on state and local government action as well.
Now, where does it say that in the 14th Amendment? And it really doesn't. I mean, that's what they teach you in law school, but basically that was not applied until 1962, or perhaps even suggested 1947, but certainly applied in 1962. Nobody at that time ever anticipated they would use the 14th Amendment to begin, of course, to take God out of our schools or any of the other things that they have done. These things were simply cooked up when the Masons took control of our Supreme Court. Did you know, as a lawyer, the Masons controlled the Supreme Court from 1941 to 1971? Did they teach you that in medical school?
In
law school?
I can't comment on the role of Masons in our society.
Well, of course, I can, because
the application of the Bill
Court.
Of Rights does go back to at least the 20s, and we had in effect de facto. Substitutes for slavery, even if it wasn't the same legal system with the Jim Crow laws for probably most of that time into the turn of the 20th century. So the federal government certainly was not very vigorous at defending the rights of African Americans in the generations to follow the Civil War.
But, of course, the whole idea of the 14th Amendment was certainly never to apply of these same restrictions to the states that they applied to the federal government. The First Amendment was very, very specific. Congress shall pass no law or make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And that was very specific. They always wanted these other matters to be taken care of at the state level. And, of course, the people who would, take away our freedom have always wanted to put those restrictions on the state as well. So that, of course, they could be brought under the same control and they could take God out of our society.
Well, when it comes to the Establishment Clause, and you're certainly quoting it accurately, all of the states dismantled their religious establishments during that colonial period. There was a universal appreciation that the establishment of religion was both bad for state and bad for the church. One book that I was looking at over this past weekend, a friend showed me, the sociologist was pointing out that when the clergy were supported by tax dollars, they were lazy, they were corrupt, they were unspiritual, and the state of the church was just terrible. And that was one of the motivations for the disestablishment, to cut off the funding for the clergy and basically push the church into the free market, where if the clergy wanted a salary, they had to perform. And to this day, the American church, for all of our spiritual problems and confusion, is still a whole lot better than the church in the rest of Western countries in Western Europe, where you still have a great deal of state establishment of religion with official religions and the priests and the clergy. being supported by the government and nobody going to church.
Yes, but of course the thing was there's no time at any place within the founding of this country or its evolution of it has there ever been this concept you couldn't mention God in school, you couldn't have a simple prayer, God is good, God is great, thank you for this food, you couldn't have the Ten Commandments. That was put forward by the people who were intent upon destroying Christianity in America and replacing it, of course, with another religion.
Well, the only thing I can't comment on what motives were behind that. I would simply say that the current move to get government to promote the Ten Commandments is a clear signal to me as a minister that the churches have been failing both to teach people the commandments and to teach them that the new covenant means the commandments written upon the heart, that we internalize them, because if the church were doing its job, we wouldn't be asking government to do the job for us.
Well, of course, but that would include taking all of our children out of the government schools, because the purpose of government schools is to destroy the faith of the children in God, and they're doing a great job, and of course, by simply pushing evolution, telling children that the Bible is lies, because it says, of course, we were created. The purpose of schools today is not, of course, to educate our children, it's to indoctrinate them in atheism, evolution, and of course, the schools have so much more time than the churches do. Yes, the churches have failed, but of course, how can a church which has a child there for a few hours once a week compete with a school that has those children 5 days a week and uses their purpose to, of course, indoctrinate our children? They're not educating them, they're indoctrinating them.
Well, Seventh-day Adventists operate the largest parochial school system in the world, second only, or Protestant system, I should say, second only to the Catholics. We are very, very strong believers in Christian education. And I certainly would agree with you, Stan, that any Christian has an obligation to give their kids a Christian education and to have their kids in Christian schools or to teach them at home. You cannot pass off the obligation to raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord by giving them to the, as you call them, the government schools. And I guess I would go one step further and simply say that public schools really conceptually are a violation of the whole concept of what America is all about.
You're absolutely right.
That, you know, the whole purpose of our Republican system of freedom is that the marketplace of ideas be free and open competition. But when government steps in and controls 90% of the marketplace of what's shaping that marketplace of ideas, then you have stifled competition and you have one worldview dominating and monopolizing. They have every right to have that worldview, but I don't think it's fair to have a particular worldview paid for by tax dollars. I think we'd do far better to go back to a completely free market system of education.
Well, then you side with the people that who want to take the the cross down off the top of a hill if it happens to be on government property, or take the Ten Commandments out, an example of that in a courthouse, really basically saying that our laws were based upon the Ten Commandments. You would support the atheists who want to take those out?
I'm sorry, you're saying that you think I'm on their side?
I was trying to find out how you would feel about those issues. For instance, Santa Monica has a cross on top of a mountain. Now,
we have that case happening right here. I live in Oxnard in Ventura. I've been watching the case very closely in the town where I go to church, and there's a cross case. Honestly, I think that the solution that has been found in other cities like San Francisco is to have a private entity come in and purchase the land basically simply for the price of agreeing to maintain it in its current condition and to maintain the cross. And that way, I believe that we have adequate religious freedom if we can fully express our religious faith privately without asking government to get behind us or to lend its power and prestige behind the symbols of the faith. So I don't really think the faith needs the power of government, but there is certainly an appropriate way, and government, neither should government show hostility to the faith.
But there is hostility to the faith, there's no question.
Well, and so when we have these compromise situations where government will, here in Ventura, what they're trying to do is find a buyer to buy the acre surrounding the cross, you know, for a nominal sum, with an agreement to maintain it the way it is, well, then there's no question it is a private expression of faith, and the government is out of the business of promoting the faith, and it's a win-win situation in terms of the Constitution and the religious freedom and the expression of the symbol of the faith.
Well, and maybe we ought to change the Constitution, because, of course, it says in this day of our Lord, which is, of course, they were talking about Christianity. Should we remove that from the Constitution? And, of course, there's a provision in the Constitution that says the president has so many days to sign a bill, except for, you know, Sunday. Of course, that doesn't count as a day. Or how about when the Supreme Court opens every one of its sessions and the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court? Should we do away with that as well?
No, I'm not suggesting that we should.
Well, but that, of course, is exactly what this whole idea is, that we should let them tell the local community that they can't have a cross on government land, or that the courthouse can't have the Ten Commandments. Actually, if you've been to the Supreme Court building, as I have in Washington, D.C., up above where the justices sit, why they have a replica of the Ten Commandments? Should we take that down in the Supreme Court building, or should we leave that there and take it down in every other courthouse in the country? There is actually an anti-Christian organization, well-coordinated all across America, that hates Christianity, that is pushing pagan religions in our schools. And I certainly admire the Seventh-day Adventists for having the courage to do what they believe is right and having schools. And I know that, of course, your Christian school, Seventh-day Adventist school, in the community where I live is outstanding. In fact, the people who work for us have their children going there, and we know what they're doing. They're doing a great job. But, of course, unfortunately, all the religious groups in this country are not as dedicated as the Seventh-day Adventists, and unfortunately, we're losing a whole generation of children who are being indoctrinated with a hatred of America, a hatred of God, in our schools today. And many of them, of course, will never return. Right now, we've got Tony calling in. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, Dr. Stan.
Go ahead.
I got a question for your guest. Now, you were saying that the ideal situation would be for a private party to come in and purchase this property and then maintain the whatever religious emblem that was in question. Well, my question is, is this property going to be taxed by the government? And how do you feel about the government having the power to tax the church, or church property, or church expression, or religious expression, whatever you want to call it?
One of our founders, I don't remember who it was, who said that the power to tax is the power to destroy. I was party witness to that in a blatant case of discrimination back in New York when I was still in law practice there. We represented a independent ministry, is what it really was, a Seventh-day Adventist group that practices health ministry, and they were operating a health food vegetarian restaurant with treatment rooms for natural treatments in New York City, with a kind of a retreat center in the country. And the finances clearly showed that this was genuinely a non-for-profit organization. They were not making money. They were living on donations. And people were not really getting paid very well either. They were given room and board and probably barely complied with minimum wage laws when you count in the value of the room and board. But the county wanted to tax that property and succeeded politically in the courts, even though all of the facts and all of the law was against them, because it was organized as a 501c3. And really, that tax burden was the straw that broke the camel's back and put this wonderful ministry out of business. And it's still, the discrimination is continuing to this day. 10 years later, They're trying to sell the property, and it's been tied up for many years with a developer, and the county is even discriminating against the developer wanting to put houses in what's otherwise a residential area. And all we can think of is it's residual hostility because of what we've been fighting with the various lawsuits over the years. So the power to tax, I've seen very practically, is the power to destroy. And back to the situation that the caller mentioned with you know, a private entity buying the land where a cross is in public view in a park, typically the arrangement is made with a nonprofit organization. So the land would not be put on the tax rolls. It would still be tax-exempt property.
Now, I understand, though, that if we're thinking of the same case in Southern California, the people who want to do away with the cross really don't want it sold to another entity. They don't want the cross there.
Well, that is true. And I cannot disagree, Stan, with your assessment that there is an anti-Christian hostility among some. Clearly, that's been manifest, and you know that's why we're taking a kind of we're pro the Constitution, but we're also pro the faith, and we think that there are ways of accomplishing both fidelity to our constitutional values without restricting religious freedom. After all, the First Amendment was designed in both parts, well, in all the parts. Non-establishment, free exercise, free speech, free press, right of assembly, they all touch on different aspects of freedom of religion and the right to practice your faith. Of course, they're broader than that. Speech is broader than religious speech, and so is assembly and the press. But they all had religious freedom as, you know, in mind and relate completely to religious freedom.
All right, Tony, do you have any other questions? Was that an answer that you...
Well, I think you know me well enough to know, Dr. Stan, that I wasn't really thrilled with that answer, but I know it was a good attempt, and I appreciate it. But, I go a little bit farther than that because I just don't believe that the government has any right at all whatsoever in any way, shape, or form to tell the Church of Christ anything or to tell any believer anything at all.
No, but of
period.
Course, the issue is not whether they're going to tell the believer what to believe. The issue is, of course, as far as the Ten Commandments are concerned, what's the harm of having the Ten Commandments, which is the basis of our law in this country, there within the courthouse? And, of course, this is the issue that's coming up in Alabama very, very soon. Our laws were built upon the Ten Commandments. And, of course, anybody who's read Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, which was the basis of American law up until for the first 100, 150 years of this country, knows, of course, that our law was all built on the Bible. And, of course, it was only subsequently when the anti-Christians got in there that they removed that and that we changed from the commentaries on the laws of England to whatever we're using today. And, of course, when we built our concepts not upon the Bible, not upon the Constitution, but upon case law made by men aimed at destroying the fundamentals of this country.
Well, Stan, if I could, I'd like to pick up on Tony's comment that government should not be telling believers what to do. It really implicates the erosion of the free exercise clause. And I have been astonished as I have seen really secular commentators approve of what the Supreme Court, and by the way, it was your beloved Justice Scalia that you quoted earlier favorably in one case, who said that religious liberty is a luxury that a well-ordered society can no longer afford. And what's happening with free exercise is really any of us who take our faith so seriously that we are somehow out of step with public policy, that we might need accommodation in some way, that we might say that the law should not restrict our religious practice. Well, we're considered fundamentalists. And, of course, fundamentalist today is almost a synonym for terrorist. If you're a fundamentalist, you're a suspect. You're potentially dangerous. And we want to scrutinize very carefully why you're out of harmony with public policy. And so the rule now is that the law applies regardless of your religious practice, and it will restrict your religious practice. And if you really think that you ought to be able to have an exception to that law, well, you better go convince a majority in your state legislature or the Congress that agrees with you and change the law and give you an accommodation, because we're no longer going to recognize that you have a fundamental right to practice your faith. We can regulate your faith out of business if we want to, and you can't say anything about it.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest. And Tony, if you want to stay on, you may.
I just got one comment.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Alan Reinach, and we're talking about the AB 17, the new legislation, of course, which will require employers to provide certainly benefits to homosexual partners. And, of course, we've got off on a lot of other issues. But, of course, my personal belief is that our laws, of course, were built upon the Ten Commandments. And, of course, this whole idea that the federal government then has been able to extend its power to the states, I believe, is wrong. I think that there's a very conscious effort to tell us, of course, that by taking the First Amendment and turning it upside down and adding in a little of the 14th Amendment and sprinkling a little of the 13th Amendment on there, that somehow you could twist the meaning of this to say that, of course, the First Amendment applied to the states as well as the people, and therefore we can't have the Ten Commandments on exhibit any place, or no community can have an exhibit of, for instance, the manger scene on government land, or certainly you could never have the Ten Commandments displayed any place because that's religious. And yet, of course, our country was built upon religion. Different than any other country, we profess it. Our freedom comes from God. If you go into our treaties, and of course the treaty of 18, Paris Treaty in 1783, talked about the Trinity, as did the treaty with the Russians in 1787. And of course, if you go into the Treaty of Guadalupe that was passed in 1848, when of course Mexico ceded states to various states to the United States, they talked about God. If you go into the decision of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States, why, of course, in 1892, I believe it was, the Supreme Court said that this was a Christian nation. Now, certainly, Abraham Lincoln put "In God We Trust" on our coinage, and of course, Eisenhower put "In God We Trust" on our paper bills. And yet, of course, there are people who say, "Oh no, we couldn't ever have God mentioned in anything public, state-wise." This is, of course, a total distortion, in my opinion, of the meaning of our country. Our freedom came from God, and once we are willing to relinquish that and say the anti-Christian bigots are right, and we're going to sit, instead of fighting the right to have a cross on public land, if the people want it there, if people don't want it there, they can get rid of it. If they want it there, they should be able to have it. No, we're going to just crawfish, and we're going to sell it to somebody else so they can keep it there. But we don't want to take a stand for anything. And I'll tell you what, people won't take a stand for anything, will certainly fall for anything. Tony, what's your comment, and do you have another question for our guest?
Oh, that was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
Right.
You're looking for.
1848.
And one thing Thomas Jefferson did when he was president, he had public funds spent on Christianizing and evangelizing the Indians. And that certainly didn't follow the so-called decision in 1947, the Supreme Court in Everson versus Board of Education, that gave us the screwball idea of separation of church and state.
But it wasn't until the Masons took over our Supreme Court in 1941 that everything began to go from bad to worse. And the fact that none of our Christian leaders will tell you that the Masons controlled the Supreme Court for 30 years, and their whole goal of this secret society that has its foundation in the ancient mystery religions is the destruction of Christianity, because they worship a different God, and they've all sworn their horrible, terrifying blood oaths for that purpose. But we never talk about that in America.
You know, it's interesting, Dr. Stan, that Tony brings up the use of federal dollars to evangelize the Indians, because the history of that is one of the greatest mistakes that I think this country has ever made. The way that Christianity was represented to the Native Americans pretty much ensured that the gospel would be rejected by most Native Americans over the last couple of centuries. And Jefferson's policy in that regard, which was continued by successive presidents, really ensured the failure of the gospel. What we have found historically is that whenever government takes upon itself the role of the church, which is God did not give to government, God gave to the church, the result is a striking failure. It's a corruption of the faith, not really an advancement of the faith. And to me, the real Republican and Protestant principles that our nation was founded upon, I certainly agree that our nation was founded upon Christian principles, but there was a dramatic difference between the kind of Catholic approach historically, which found a partnership between church and state, and of course the church was the higher partner of the two. The state had to answer to the church, and Protestantism, which really established the foundation for freedom by saying that in matters of conscience, the majority has no power. The majority, acting through legislatures, cannot work to advance the faith or to promote the faith or to be hostile to the faith, because really, religion is not the jurisdiction of government. It comes back to, Dr. Stan, what you said earlier about how limited the role of the federal government really was by our Constitution, that Congress should have no power over religion. And I think if we would return to that kind of notion of a limited role of government, both at the federal and even at the state and local levels, and limit the role government has in some areas, particularly religion, we would find ourselves prospering as a nation morally and spiritually, as well as socially and politically.
Well, I certainly think you're absolutely right as far as Jefferson's effort, and any effort, of course, on government to push religion. I think you're absolutely right that America, of course, was we did not want, of course, a state religion. We didn't want an Anglican religion. We didn't want a Baptist religion. We didn't want a Catholic religion. We just wanted people to be free to worship as they so chose. But, of course, recognizing, of course, that our foundations of this country, different than any other country, were, of course, based upon Christianity. And, in fact, if you go to the CIA website, the CIA.gov, and you can look, and they'll tell you that India is 100% Hindu, and certainly that Iraq was, 90% Muslim. But, of course, their connotation, America was 84% Christian. Even the CIA recognized this was a Christian nation, even though their purpose and goal has always been to undermine and destroy that Christian foundation of our society. But you're absolutely right. I think your point about Jefferson, although his heart may have been in the right place, his thrust was totally counterproductive. Government should never be actively promoting religion, but neither should it try to discourage it as it does today.
Well, I'd really like to get back to the issue that we started with, which is how the gay agenda is undermining religious freedom, and which lends itself nicely also to talking about the prospects for gay marriage and encouraging a if you will, a backlash against the Supreme Court decision, and encouraging people to take a stand in favor of marriage.
All right, fine.
Marriage.
Well, first, Tony, do you have anything else you want to say?
Okay, I'd like to make a comment on what you just brought up, because I agree with you what you said with Jefferson, by the way. And the only reason I brought that up was just to make the point that the Supreme Court in 1947 took it all out of whack. I agree with you on what you said. But on this issue of gay marriage and legitimizing homosexuality and the whole thing, I've given this a lot of thought, and I really believe that the reason that they're doing this is because the homosexual community obviously cannot reproduce themselves. They don't procreate. It's not possible. So they need to expand. And they want to expand by being able to adopt children and taking in foster children, et cetera, et cetera. And In my own life experience, I had a brother who was placed in a foster home with a homosexual man. He ended up dying at 26 years old from AIDS. And so I'm very sensitive about this issue. And I really believe that the whole purpose of this isn't that the homosexuals want to have all these touchy-feely, warm, funny feelings or whatever, but they want to recruit and indoctrinate more people into this perversion. And I'll let it go on there.
All right, thanks so much, Tony. Bye-bye. But, of course, so what would your solution be? We have AB 17. Where does it stand today? Assembly bill, of course, will define benefits that if you're going to give benefits, you're going to have to give benefits to, to the partners, even if they're not married. I would think that maybe the various employers should just quit giving benefits altogether to get around that.
Well, you know, there was an issue that arose with the Catholic institutions and forcing them to provide family planning services as part of the package of benefits that they would provide to their employees. And the lawsuit, in the lawsuit over that bill, the Catholic Church's position is, you know, we have to give benefits. That's an expression of our faith, too. But we cannot give these benefits to pay for services that violate our faith. So we're in a catch-22.
So what did they do?
Well, that case is still in that is pending right now before the California Supreme Court, where it's been for, well over a year, I think. It's been a long time, and the Supreme Court hasn't even had oral argument in the case yet. I filed a brief in that case. Where AB 17 is, and by the way, our listeners can keep up with the progress on our website at churchstate.org, and another website where it's, we have a petition there, but you can send, we have a really nifty system for contacting Congress, and on this issue, contacting your state senators, and that's set up at religiousliberty.info. Very, very nice system for sending emails instantly to your senators on these kinds of issues. AB 17 is poised to go to the Senate for a vote. It's passed the state California Assembly by a narrow margin, and so there is some hope that it could actually get defeated in the Senate, although the momentum right now in a liberal state like California behind gay rights is almost unstoppable. So we are afraid that the bill may pass, but we have put a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of energy into trying to defeat the bill. It really has the risk of putting religious institutions out of business if they will not adopt the gay agenda. That's really the bottom line. And what the way I'm seeing it now is they don't really care what you teach and what you do in your worship services. They'll concede us religious freedom when we go to church. But as soon as we want to be relevant and step outside of church and engage in ministry, the healing ministry of Jesus Christ, the teaching ministry of Jesus Christ, child care ministry, anything like that, we have to go along with them as a condition of existing in society and go along with their agenda. And I think, you know, Tony put one spin on it, and I don't know that he's right or that he's wrong, I just don't know, but my perception from the battles that I fought is that the conservative churches are the only institutions in society that stand between the gay community and complete social and moral acceptance and political acceptance. And so we are cast as the enemy, and it's not unusual that we would see these kinds of assaults that say either comply with these laws or you know, we'll cut you off of these various state contracts or benefits. And at this point, public-private partnerships have become so all-pervasive that many institutions can't survive without them.
And I think that anybody who enters into a contract with the state, as far as getting money from the state to pursue social goals, they're not worthy of our support.
Well,
I don't think we should ever go to the state
but
to get money for a food bank or for whatever it might be.
You know, in principle, I have a lot of sympathy for that position. The problem is that all of our religious groups, the larger ones and many of the smaller ones, have been doing things like running colleges and hospitals long before the state began to fund them. And at this point, we find ourselves in the position where let's say, about a quarter of the funding for any college comes from government grants, from Cal grants here in California, and as much as half of the budget of hospitals is insurance programs that are government-run for the poor and for the elderly, Medi-Cal, Medicare, these kinds of programs. We didn't necessarily ask for the government to get into the funding business for all these things, but at this point, we are totally at their mercy,
if I dare call it mercy.
Would
that, of course, to be included in this legislation? In other words, if you are running a hospital and, of course, you accept money from Medicare, Medicaid or Medicare, you would then, of course, be considered under contract with the state?
Well, there are contracts. There's tons of different kinds of contracts involved with all of these things. The simplest one to describe is the Cal grant. Because even though the money is going on a needs assessment basis to the student, the college has to certify that the kid is maintaining a minimum number of hours, you know, maintaining a decent course load, and maintaining a decent grade level that, you know, they're not flunking out. And so the college is under contract, and the student cannot use Cal Grant monies at that college if the college is not under contract.
But, of course, how many of these are religious religious schools?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly how many religious colleges there are in the state. The Adventists run three. We have one up in the Napa Valley where I went to school, Pacific Union College, and two here in Southern California, La Sierra University and Loma Linda University and Medical Center. I think we've got about 14 hospitals scattered around the state, at least, maybe more than that. And of course, there are quite a few other religious colleges in the state. I think Pepperdine still has some religious backbone, and I think there's some Catholic schools and some others. So it really, if all of the religious institutions really, you know, stood their ground and stood up for their principles, it would deprive the people of California of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in available services. It would be a terrible disaster for the state of California if everybody stood their ground and said, okay, have it your way. We'll just close our doors because we can't continue to operate, and there's no point in our operating if we're going to have to violate the faith.
Well, sometimes maybe you have to create a crisis to accomplish anything. It's sort of like, when you have the people, the county government employees go out on a strike. You know very well that you're eventually going to have to negotiate with them. And if our religious institutions have the courage to take a stand, why, of course, the state would have to negotiate with them, or the whole infrastructure would destroy it. This is what would happen when the people went out on strike. This is what would happen if the hospitals and colleges that have a religious background said, we're not going to put up with it. Sorry, this is the end. You take care of all of these students. Think of the people are not going to be concerned until their ox gets gored. Maybe we ought to encourage the hospitals and the universities to do what's right rather than what's expedient.
Well, I will say this. I mean, first of all, I'm not a big fan of brinksmanship. But we did consider this issue at a somewhat calmer time last year in our own church, and our executive committee that governs our institutions, our Adventist institutions here in California and some other states, took an action that said we cannot comply with this sort of thing. Now, I hope that we will have the courage of our convictions and that we will follow that policy if and when the time comes. I don't want to say that we're any more righteous than anybody else or any less prone to making these kinds of compromises, but we've certainly taken the first step and carefully weighed the implications and said, no, we can't go along with this sort of policy. Now that's our official policy. I agree we should all have the courage of our convictions, but it doesn't always work out that way, does it?
No, it doesn't, but I would hope that you would, and I hope that your church would, and I would think it would be a great plus if we had at least one church group, one Christian group, that had the courage to do what's right rather than what's expedient.
Well, and you know, Before we get to that point, though, we all have the opportunity to exercise our responsibilities as citizens and tell the government that this kind of thing is just plain wrong.
Well, of course we
and
can.
Not to have to put religious institutions to a choice between survival and compromising their faith. See, from a basic religious liberty perspective, that's the kind of government coercion that should never be applied to an individual of faith or an institution of faith.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with you at all. I'm certainly all in favor. But you have to understand that the people who have been elected to the legislature, many of them are violently anti-Christian. And, of course, with intense hatred of Christianity, and, of course, their embracing of this this dark sexual perversion, it's just like it was in ancient Sodom. It's just like it was in ancient Rome and in ancient Greece. And all of those societies eventually were destroyed because the good people allowed the wicked people into positions of power. And, of course, I charge the church with full responsibility for what's happened because they haven't had the courage to take a stand against it. At one time, of course, the church was the conscience of the community. Our sermons were aimed, of course, at probing people's or stimulating people's conscience to get them involved. And today, of course, we don't want to say anything that might be controversial because it might hurt the building fund.
Well, you know, when you liken current conditions to Sodom, Stan, I'm about ready to get up on my preacher's box and say, yes, and that's a sure sign that Christ is coming soon, and the message of the hour is to repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And, judgment begins at the house of God. Repentance begins at the house of God. We certainly have no call to tell anybody else that they have to repent unless we've done it first.
Amen to that. Well, you can get up on your preacher's box anytime on my program and make that statement because I agree with it totally. And, of course, what we need if we ever hope to save America is begin, of course, with ourselves, because each one of us has to repent and recognize that we are sinners saved by grace.
And, you know, I know you've put a lot of emphasis on the public posting of the Ten Commandments. My concern as a minister is for the new covenant experience, which is the law of God written upon the heart. That's what's supposed to happen at conversion, is a complete change of the life, so that the things that we once hated, we now love. We're in harmony with the things that are good, with the things that are written in the law, and we want to do what's right. And to me, it may have some beneficial effect to post the Ten Commandments publicly, but that's more like Old Covenant writing it on stone. And what ultimately America needs is for the law to be written in the hearts of Americans.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that at all. But, you know, of course, the tragedy is if you ask most Christians to list the Ten Commandments in their order that they were written, most Christians would have very, very real difficulty doing that because the Ten Commandments are not written upon their hearts.
Well, you know, I've got my two boys with me here tonight in the morning for worship. I'm going to have to ask them if they can recite, at least if not the complete wording of the commandments, what they are, number 1 through 10. And honestly, if they can't, well, I better make sure it's my responsibility that they know. My boys are 7 and 8, and I say that by way of example. You know, it's not the school's responsibility. It's not even the church's responsibility. The parents are the ones who are going to be held accountable for training up our kids.
And, of course, this is as it should be. Of course, we were also to discipline our children. Try to discipline your child. We were over at a theme park about 2 weekends ago, and there were a couple of kids that were the parents would tell them to do one thing, they'd do exactly the opposite. And my feeling was, you know, these kids need a good application of a little force there to the rear ends. And then, of course, realizing that if the parents had done that, why, they could be held for child abuse. What is madness do we have today when parents can be punished for spanking a child in public when they need a good spanking? But, of course, we're told in the scriptures, you spare the rod and you spoil the child. And yet this is what we're doing. They are using government to, of course, break down the family, break down the discipline, to raise a whole race of children who cannot read the Bible in you know, in school, but of course they, when they go to prison, why then they can read the Bible. And we wonder why we have almost 1% of our population behind bars in America today, and simply because America has turned its back on the teaching of God's law.
Well, I'm certainly a strong proponent of discipline, but I can't resist putting out to you and your listeners that the rod that was written about was more akin to the shepherd's rod, which is used to guide, not to not to spank. That children need lines drawn, and lines clearly drawn and enforced. And if they are enforced, then spanking will be needed very, very infrequently, and really should not be needed in public. I don't take a position. I don't think our church takes a position one way or the other on either using or completely abstaining from spanking. We certainly don't think that the moderate use of it ought to be considered child abuse. But I think if we were more diligent to draw those lines, the kids would know where the lines are, and they want to know. They're happier that way when they know where the boundaries are. They need those boundaries drawn.
All right, well, we're just about out of time, Alan. What did you want our listeners to do about AB 17?
Well, the best place to respond, it's so easy. 60 seconds is all it takes. If you go to religiousliberty.info, you can put your zip code in there, and it will come up with several bills, but the first one is AB 17, and you can contact your senators. And what I did in my church was, after the worship service, I told everybody to come on back, and we had the computer in the church office, and we sent 30 or 40 letters after church. And it's so easy to do at religiousliberty.info. And frankly, if everybody that was listening did that, I think it would be very difficult for the Senate to pass this bill.
All right, fine. And so religiousliberty.info, and help to get the word out and get it out to others as well. Christianity is under attack today on all sides. And, of course, we're at war, and most people don't even know that war is taking place. Okay, give our parting thoughts to our listeners, and we'll let you go.
Well, I just think that we need to be careful about how the religious freedom is for institutions as well as individuals, and it's the warfare is heating up. The question of whether we will have religious institutions 10, 20 years from now in the way things are going that don't compromise on their faith is really an open question.
Well, of course, you know, we look at these religious fundamentalists, these Islamic terrorists, and they're fundamentalists. But the trouble is that, of course, we are also fundamentalists. And they are, of course, going to demonize anybody who's a fundamentalist, anybody who believes in the Jewish religion, who believes in the Muslim religion, who believes in the Christian religion. Don't think for one minute that that's not exactly what's intended. God bless you, Alan, and keep up the great work, and keep in touch with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show tonight, Dan.
Good night. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Alan Rennick. And of course, we've been talking about AB, of course, 17. And, of course, this is going to be just one more path along the way to legitimizing the homosexual death style. And it really is a death style. And if you care about homosexuals, you're going to tell them what's wrong with what they're doing and tell them about God having a plan for them. And God doesn't want people to be homosexuals because, of course, they die at such a young age. It's unhealthy. They're not happy. I mean, if you talk to a homosexual, he'll really be honest with you. He'll tell you he's miserable, but he's trapped in this system, and he doesn't know how to get out. It's a compulsive addiction, and our job is to help them, and the only real way is a personal relationship with our Lord. Well, until tomorrow at the same time, then this is Dr. Stamm asking you to pray for America and to pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America, our value, our freedom, our future. We're under attack today.